It seems that the Jews were a little too pleased at the time when the Nazi government seemed to succeed in its job to throw the communists out, the Stalinists out. And this is coming back to plague them. And I think that, as with everybody else, the new government is putting on the screws, and they're cleaning up as much as they can. Now, the relationship between the Jewish community and the SSE...
Well, before you go on with that, the net result of what you're describing to me, the change in the personnel of the top layer of command in the Jewish community, you started to say, might indicate that the program of relief in transit would be affected in some way or other. Were you about to go on to describe that at this point? All right.
We have to wait and see just exactly who the people will be with whom we will have to deal. It's a question of confidence in the relationship, in turning over considerable sums of money to these people. I personally, based on my lengthy experience with the Hungarian government and others in a welfare program, have every hope that regardless of who the people may be, it will continue to be possible to do an effective relief job.
This relief job reaches how many people at the present time? And what form of relief gets to them, briefly?
Well, the relief job, which is carried out through the Union of Jewish Community, reaches some 11,000 people, most of them people over the age of 60 and 65, through soup kitchens, through parcel service, food parcel service, through medical services, clothing, and other services of a similar nature. Over and above that, of course, we have another relief program which is not carried on through the Union of Jewish Communities and which is continuing as before. There has been no interference with that, and which reaches another probably 25,000 people in the country. Now,
that's as far as Hungary is concerned. Have you anything to say about the internal program, the relief and transit program, if it exists at all, in the other two countries, in Poland and in Romania?
In Poland, we have been carrying on a relief program involving a rather limited number of people until the repatriants came into the picture. Since the repatriants appeared, you know perhaps that something like 7,000 Jewish repatriants appeared in Poland, of whom, according to best information available, some 3,000 to 4,000 have left the country for Israel. We didn't have to address ourselves to this problem immediately, but as of recent, we have had a number of requests, that is, the SSE had, and the World Jewish Congress had, and other Jewish groups had, requests from the religious community of Poland, the community which is headed by the two men, Dr. Lebo and Engineer Frankel, to provide help with their programs which address themselves to the problem of the repatriants. The repatriants who have been left behind, who have been stopped from leaving the country, are being resettled by the Polish government in Lower Silesia. They are being given apartments which were left vacant by Polish Jews who left for Israel. Other than that, they get a per capita grant of 500 zlotys. And with that, they are supposed to integrate themselves, go look for jobs, and generally be independent.
What does 500 zlotys amount to?
500 zlotys, according to the what you would call a free market rate of exchange, would be $5.
Well, now, you have what I would call a caseload of repatriates to worry about, which at the moment doesn't appear to be large. But if the repatriation is to resume in large numbers again from Russia, and if they do not leave for Israel, might it be assumed that your responsibility for that group of people would grow larger and larger once you take on the initial responsibility for caring for any of them, through the SSE, that is? And now you have 2,000 or 3,000. Supposing you had 20,000, would you be able to, or would you be willing to take care of that number?
Let me first say that the repatriation of Jews from Russia to Poland has practically come to a stop. Because Jews are no longer permitted to leave the country after repatriation, they don't care to come to Poland, but they sit it out in Russia. As long as they aren't in Siberia, exactly in Siberia, as long as they are in places like Latvia and Lithuania, former Latvia, Lithuania, etc., they have a roof over their head, they may have a livelihood, and they refuse to go through with the repatriation, which is optional, as you know, not wanting to face what they know these repatriants are facing who are unable to leave Poland for Israel. There's a school of thought, and to which I also subscribe, that this repatriation movement of Jews to Poland may be restarted if it becomes known that somebody like ourselves actually provides for the needs of the repatriants once they have returned to Poland. And we are now finding ourselves in difficulties with this program. The religious community has just written a letter to the SSE explaining that based on advice, in quotation marks, which means, of course, advice from the authorities, it is not desirable that the SSE should give assistance to individual repatriants. We have been giving this assistance by sending PKO parcels to them based on names and addresses which were supplied us by the Israelis. The religious community advises the SSE that it is not looked upon favorably by the government nor by it that this relief program should continue. They say that it may lead to a demoralization of the people. It may make them dependent upon outside assistance. And it may make them unwilling to adjust to the reality of their situation. And for all of these reasons, they suggest that if the SSE wishes to give assistance to Polish repatriants, it should channel its assistance through the religious community for a more constructive program.
Have you answered that letter yet, or haven't you made up your mind what you're going to do about it?
Well, let me first explain what they mean by constructive program. They want to get us away entirely from giving assistance, welfare assistance to individuals. What they want is lump sums with which they can finance, for example, retraining activities. They say that the people have to adjust themselves to working conditions in Poland, that they have to open schools and retraining centers for them, and they need money for that purpose. They also say that they would like to provide, for example, summer vacations for the children of the repatriants, and they want to carry on some large-scale program for that purpose. Now, we have answered that letter by saying that we are perfectly willing to sit down and talk with them about what would be a reasonable program. But in order for us to be able to do so, it would be necessary and from our point of view desirable that a person like Dr. Hyman would be invited to come to Warsaw to have conversations with these people right on the spot. We haven't said that we wouldn't do one thing or that we would want to do another thing. We've left this entirely open for discussion with them. In the meantime, We are continuing, nevertheless, to send these parcels to the repatriants because we believe it is absolutely essential that they should have a means of livelihood. The 500 zlotys, as I explained to you, which at the open market rate of exchange are worth about $5, are, of course, a drop in the bucket. They don't do anything for these people. And these people are unable to find jobs. That is one of the reasons why Polish Jews are leaving the country, because they can no longer find employment as needed. And the repatriants, of course, are at a disadvantage. Also, they are being sent to places where which are unrelated to opportunities for employment. We feel that they must be assisted. We are assisting them. We feel that it is not undesirable to defy the attitude of the government and of the religious committee. We feel that we put ourselves in a better bargaining position if we show them that despite their warnings to the contrary, we find ways and means of getting at these people, getting relief and assistance to these people, and we feel that if, as and when, Dr. Hyman will be invited to come, and we honestly believe that he will be invited to come, we are in a better position to work out a relief program which is more adequate than they are now planning to have it. And we also, of course, hope, as I said before, that by giving this much encouragement to the repatriants already in Poland, we may stimulate a renewed movement of Jews from Russia into Poland. Why do we do this? We do it because we are convinced that at some point in the foreseeable future, the Polish government will have to permit continued emigration, even of repatriants to Israel. And we want to place Jews now in Russia in a position where they can take advantage of these opportunities once they arise.
Very good, sound, logical position, and I would call it very good planning for the future. It reminds me of the time 10 years ago when before you could get Jews into then Palestine, you first had to get them into the DP camps in Germany. So now it's a question, you've got to get them out of Russia into Poland in the hopes that someday they will again be able to get out of Poland to Israel. All right, Charlie, look, that was very good. Now, that gives us a kind of a general recapitulation of Eastern Europe. I want to ask Herb Katsky about North Africa and some field trips he's made recently. Before we give the microphone over to him, do you have anything else you want to add?
I don't think I've said anything about Romania and Czechoslovakia.
No, that's right.
I think you would want to know that there's just nothing coming out of Romania at the present time, and that we have been definitely told by Rabbi Rosen that the government has vetoed any introduction of relief supplies into Romania by the SSE. They have told him to so advise everybody on his trip to Central Europe, and he has done so. There's nothing doing as far as that is concerned. We're also having difficulties now to send medical supplies into Romania. We've had any number of parcels with medicines urgently needed by sick people in Romania returned by the postal authorities. We are trying now to find out what is happening, why this is being done, and to find a way to get them in despite the difficulties. We have had to do this time and again, and we have always found a way. This may be purely bureaucracy, or it may be something deeper. It may be, again, a closing off of relief supplies of any kind to the Jews of Romania, pending some new developments which are being prepared by the authorities and the exact nature of which we don't know. As far as Czechoslovakia is concerned, we also have very definite news that it is not agreeable to the Czech government to have the SSE undertake a program similar in Czechoslovakia, similar to what is being done in Hungary. So they have made up their minds about the SSE, probably based on their own investigations, which would indicate that the JDC has something to do with it, and the JDC is still persona non grata in those countries.
Now, and I would probably add that the attitude of those two countries is due to the orthodoxy of their communist position, which is really saying the same thing. They are the most orthodox communist countries, Romania and Czechoslovakia, and therefore anything having to do with the West, such as the JDC, is the most taboo to them.
Now, as far as Russia is concerned, there has been an ever-increasing need for supplies to be sent in there by various groups, including, for example, Lubavitcher, including the Association of Baltic Jews in the United Kingdom. The demands made upon us for relief supplies to be sent into Russia is an ever-growing one. And what we are unable to do in one area, in other words, for example, in Czechoslovakia, is doubly and triply made up by increased demands made upon us from other areas, such as, for example, Russia.
Okay, Bocher, is that it? Thanks very much, Charlie. Herb Katsky says that he's got a full report on North Africa, Morocco, Tangier, Algiers, Tunisia, down at a staff meeting on June the 6th, and it's being typed up now, and we should have it within 10 days in the office, and so there's no point in his repeating the stuff into the machine at this point. We'll take the verbatim notes from his report last month. But he's got one footnote to add about immigration from Iran, and that was not included in the last staff notes. It will be in the next set of staff notes, but we might as well get that thing on the record now.
So far as immigration from Iran to Israel is concerned, the Jewish agency in Tehran has 10,000 people registered in Iran, most anxious to go to Israel as soon as they can. The larger proportion of these 10,000 people have been medically examined, and they have passed the social criteria for admission to the country. There are no difficulties in getting passports or exit permits or anything else for these people to get out of the country. The big difficulty is one of transportation. The Sokhnut sends one plane a month to Iran, which carries, if the thing is fully loaded, about 80 or 85 people, and that's the only limiting factor on people moving from Iran to Israel at the present time. This results in a movement of about 900 a year, which would be 12 times 80, instead of the 10,000 getting out. They're most anxious to go. They tell me that the letters which are coming back from Israel to Iran at the present time are most optimistic and are encouraging family members to come down to Israel as soon as they can get there. The people are steamed up and they're anxious to go. The position is such that individuals who have been selected several years ago and who are ready to go are becoming sick and tired of waiting in the towns from which they were selected or in which they are selected, and they're taking off on their own, coming up to Tehran, hoping that in that way, by being personally and physically present in Tehran, some means would be found to get them to Israel more quickly. In my view, it would be extremely helpful, not only from the point of view of the people who want to go to Israel, but also from the point of view of Iran itself, if this proportion of Jewish people could be assisted to move to Israel at the earliest possible moment. Perhaps while you're in
Israel, you can ask about it and find out why.
What you're suggesting is that here are people who are ready, willing to go, who have no technical obstacles in their way, who are good human material, and the rate at which they're being taken is pathetically small. You say in a joke that somebody in authority ought to be asked why more Iranians aren't being taken than just one plane load a month. I don't want to ask the question because I know the kind of an answer that I'll get. They'll say, get more money, we'll take more Iranians.
That's your problem. You're supposed to get a campaign, and I'm giving you 10,000 customers.
Well, from the point of view of the UJA campaign, I'm not at all sure that it's a question of funds alone. which is holding these people back in Iran. I think that Iran, which politically for the moment for the Jews is quiet, was put somewheres lower down on the list of priorities than some other countries from whence the Jewish people had to be moved more rapidly. But if it is true, and it appears to be true, that there's going to be an abatement in the rate of immigration from the Eastern European countries, and it would appear also that the rate of movement from the North African countries also is abated for the time being, then it would seem that this movable group of 10,000, which can be gotten out reasonably quickly, ought to move higher up than on the list of priorities as a source of people who would be able to go to Israel and go to there promptly.
This is a fair point to be made, and I know you will ask people in authority about it, as shall I. Let me thank both you guys for putting the time in on this thing, and a what?
What'd she say? Herb, I want to tell you it was a pleasure and a privilege to have this interview.
Your unseen radio audience will hate you from now on, Charlie. Good night, gentlemen. To see to it that the immigration continues, so that, as far as Poland is concerned, the indications all are in a positive direction, at least on the present level. As far as Hungary is concerned, there are 2,000 people who have received passports and who are waiting to go, and those 2,000 will be brought out as time and conditions permit, and they should be coming out fairly quickly. As far as Romania is concerned, it seems to be quite small, almost negligible at the moment, but again, the developments in Russia might turn out to be of such a nature as to make us slightly optimistic about future possibilities in Romania. Not only the developments in Russia, but the removal of certain people in Romania herself, including some Jews, might make the opportunities greater for immigration arrangements in the future. That's as far as Eastern Europe is concerned. As far as Egypt is concerned, it seems to be running its course, and by the end of the year, probably there will be almost no one left, which is another way of saying that those who want to come out and come to Israel will already have been brought out. As far as North Africa is concerned, negotiations are going on, or more properly, are being begun again in order to have what Tsour in Paris calls an assisted individual emigration. The policy of the Moroccans is still the same. They're against mass immigration. They're still theoretically in favor of individual immigration. The argument now is that individual immigration has to have an assist from somebody. The fact in Morocco is that without somebody to pressure for the processing of passports, the government simply doesn't issue them. When the people apply for them themselves, the red tape and the reluctance are such as to indicate that they aren't going to be given in large numbers. As a matter of fact, the figure I have is that 35 individual passports were given last month. Where people applied for them without any help.
Are you grinding it just like this?
Well, the big thing to remember about Morocco, I don't think that we ought to come out with this now, but the time may come when we may have to come out with it, is that there is no country outside the Iron Curtain countries where you have an Iron Curtain policy on immigration. Such as you have in Morocco at the present time in regard to Jews. I think that this is a point to remember, because it's a point that may have to be made big use of at a certain point of time if there's no other way.
All right, and therefore that leads us to a question of what the prognosis looks like. Apparently, talking in the broadest terms and obviously with plenty of latitude for mistakes one way or the other, it might be fair to say that for next year, or perhaps even at an annual rate which would begin at the end of this year, there might be as many as 3,000 or perhaps 3,500 a month from Eastern Europe, talking about Poland, Hungary, and Romania altogether, with fluctuations. Poland may go down, Romania may go up, but present calculations, with everything in a state of flux, seem to lead to the conclusion that one might estimate 3,500 a month from Eastern Europe. As far as Egypt is concerned, going over into 1958, one should say that perhaps 500 a month would be the maximum. It might be lower than that, which would represent a final cleaning up of the Egyptian situation. Now, as far as North Africa is concerned, which means mainly Morocco, it's been running at the rate presently of 1,000 or perhaps 1,200 a month. It could be stepped up beyond that. And therefore, to talk about any figure for next year is really premature at the moment, because it depends on the way the present negotiations come out. It depends on what the rate in Europe turns out to be for next year. There are two other areas which must come in for consideration at this time. Although we haven't paid any attention to them up to now, they represent problems which can't go on indefinitely without somebody paying some attention to them. One is Turkey, where the economic conditions are such that the Jews, together with the middle class in general, and also because of the anti-foreign spirit in Turkey, find themselves very badly squeezed, and really nothing at all has been done either to help or to encourage them. The Jewish population of Turkey at the moment is, the present population of Turkey is 50,000, and over the past half dozen years or so, there have been as many as 25 or 30,000 who have worked their way here, which means that there are many connections of relatives and families, and it's reasonable to assume that if some encouragement were given to this population, a fairly large number would turn to Israel if they became the subject or the object of attention. Second problem area to which no attention has been paid is Iran, and there again we can listen back to what Katsky had to say about that. Shragai's figures are somewhat larger. Shragai says there are as many as 40,000 people who are under immediate conditions of duress to be moved. The sacha kol of the whole business is that when you take Eastern Europe at a figure of 3,500 downward, or you take North Africa at a figure of 1,500 upward, and you add in the pressing demands from two new places, Turkey and Iran, you can very well reach a figure of 6,000 to 7,000 a month, which might turn out to be the median figure for 1958. 6,000 to 7,000 a month would be anywhere between 70,000 and 80,000 a year. This isn't the dramatic 100,000 a year that we talked about in 1957, but it certainly represents a very substantial chunk, larger, obviously, than any of the middle years of 51, 52, 3, 4, big enough still to be very respectable, and containing a very large element of Eastern European immigration, which is the thing that I was concerned about.
I want to say, make one or two comments. First of all, about the size of the monthly immigration figures. We're being very realistic about that here. We have to be, because it's not simply a question of bringing people to Israel. It's also a question of setting them properly economically once they are here. And therefore, our policy has to be that we must give overall priority of number to the escape immigration that's moving in and moving out of its countries of origin against a possible deadline that may fall down any minute. That's why, obviously, in relation to Eastern Europe, the attitude will continue to be what it has been this year, namely that whoever can come out will come in. So if we're simply there trying to ask ourselves how many we can expect to come out under prevailing political conditions, and we reach a figure of, let's say, 3,500 a month from Eastern Europe. Now, obviously, if there is going to be a change in the condition in Romania, which affects a quarter of a million Jews, which will enable Aliyah to begin from there, that too would be included in the country of priority. Now, if we were to be aiming at high immigration figures, as we really ought to be, then there'd be no difficulty in 1958 in bringing in 100,000 Jews, because there are enough candidates, more than enough, and more than enough possibilities of movement from Turkey, Iran, and North Africa to make up the slack. 100,000 a year means 8,500 a month. It's quite feasible for us to bring out 5,000 Jews from countries other than Eastern Europe and bring them to Israel, so that we could adopt a policy of that kind. The financial realities stand in the way of it, and also because, although there are these scores of thousands of candidates for Aliyah in these countries, we can't regard them as an escape Aliyah in the immediate sense as you regard the Eastern European Aliyah as an escape Aliyah. In relation to that Aliyah, therefore, the non-Eastern European, we can, in all good conscience, afford to take the position that if we don't see where the resources are coming from to absorb these people concurrently with their arrival in this country, then we ought to take it, we ought to stretch it out a bit. The reason for adopting that attitude, which seems on the surface to be callous, is this. Now, experience has shown that the worst conceivable thing you can do if you want to encourage an immigration movement or answer an immigration need is not to be able to absorb it properly. If, in other words, we have an Aliyah of 5,000 a month from non-Eastern European sources, always assuming that there is no blow-up which converts these people from potential refugees into immediate refugees who have to be saved come what may, if we bring them in, and we bring them into Ma'a Barot, and we bring them into Pachonim, and all the rest of it, and we put the country in a position where it's not able to provide them with a minimum of employment as soon as they arrive in the country, it won't take many months before these people will be writing back to their relatives, telling them to wait. It was precisely the ship-to-village system of absorption that we developed with the UJA help during the slack period of the immigration from 1952 to 1955 that made it possible afterwards to increase the figures, because there's always a pressure on a Jew to leave Morocco. But in addition to the pressure on him to leave Morocco, there's got to be an attraction for him to come to Israel. Unless, of course, the physical and economic pressure on him in Morocco is so terribly great that he doesn't care what happens to him as long as he gets out of there. Now, I think it has to be understood that that is not the situation in Morocco at this time. There is a pressure, there is a desire to leave, but the pressure has not reached the point where a Jew will leave come what may, and no matter what the circumstances are in the countries to which he comes. And I say that on the business of the size of the immigration. That brings me to the next comment, and I mean, talking about this business of what, of how we explain this whole position to people in America. I think that the cardinal thing is for us to realize that Eastern Europe is in a state of constant flux. I think that there will be 50 different interpretations of the latest changes, political changes in the Soviet Union. I think that the only certain thing about those changes is that they did take place. In other words, this is not the static, inflexible, monolithic system that we have been accustomed to assume for 30 years or more
to exist in the Soviet Union. We are not dealing with an inflexible state of affairs in Eastern Europe. We are dealing with a highly fluctuating situation. In that kind of a situation, there is a chance of saving Jews. We saw that in 1957 in relation to Poland and Hungary. We may see it in 1958 in relation to Romania. We may even see it in relation to the Soviet Union. A few months ago, if you talked about the possibility of mass IDR from Russia, you were regarded as crazy. In the light of the changes that are taking place in the Soviet Union, this thought is no longer crazy. Apparently anything can happen there at this time. Our major theme, therefore, I think, has got to be that we've got to keep our eyes firmly fixed on Eastern Europe, see what goes on there in order to be able to seize an opportunity as soon as it arises. I don't think that it can be claimed that the Jewish people in America or in other parts of the free world were psychologically conditioned to the opportunities that developed with the Polish Aliyah. And I don't think that we've made as much of it as we could. We've done a first-rate job of absorbing the people in Israel, but we haven't done anything like the job that we should have done in terms of even preparing the...
The other difficulty in Beersheba, of course, is the heat from Poland. And it'll take some time before they'll be able to work throughout the day without losing their vitality. At the same settlement of Miftachim called Yesha, I met an Egyptian agent for pharmacy products, worked in Egypt, very good income, and he came to Miftachim. He told me that he didn't feel like staying in the place. He thought that he'll stay there for a couple of weeks until he'll hunt for a better job. But then he stayed for a longer time, and when I met him last week, he said, well, I don't know why I really did want to go away from this Yesha, because I feel entirely different man now. I feel better in the morning, and I really intend to stay here. And he is now the intellectual leader of that community.
Now, look, you know that there's a serious problem with this migration. It's very large. 100,000 people in a year is a tremendous number of people. Houses and jobs are only the beginning of what you have to find. You have schools, you have health problems, you have 1,001 problems. Therefore, let me ask you frankly, what is the attitude, first your own personal attitude, and secondly the attitude of friends and colleagues of yours, about cutting this thing down, taking fewer people, spreading it over more years? Do you feel, or your friends feel, that the country should go on taking in so many Olim, or you should begin to cut down as a policy?
People I discuss this thing with are mainly army people, and we seem to laugh off any idea of reducing the number of newcomers. We rather feel that whatever we have should be shared out to those that come in. We feel that there is a way where things work, pay, could be shared out to more people, if only for one sole purpose, to bring as many and as quickly as one can. This is army circles and generally people who tend to view the country as a whole, and I take it as their average opinion. It's also my own opinion.
Following the evening with Lasko, which was a very joyful and pleasant experience, although it went too late, we spent the next day down at Eilat. Now, this thing at Eilat has become just absolutely fantastic. The last time I was there was in 1950 or 51. There's practically nothing there, a couple of houses. Now there are something like 3,000 people living there. The oil tanks are being built in a crevice into the hills so that you can hardly see them, and yet they're very much there, very skillfully camouflaged. The Navy has got a concrete pier and a couple of frigates tied up there. The British have left Aqaba, the Jordanian town across the bay, so that there are no more British boats out in that harbor. The bathing has become quite an important part of life. All of the soldiers find their only possible relaxation down at the beach. Everybody swims with a snorkel tube, and they pick up coral pieces, and it's quite exciting. The amount of sweat that's been expended to get every single item down there is quite incredible. Everything is flown down or brought down in heavy trucks after a laborious ride through the whole Negev. And yet there has sprung up in the midst of that crater-like desert, which looks like the surface of the moon, this fantastic copper processing plant with huge steel girders and great vats and tremendous buildings with generators. It's just an incredible sight. There's no relationship to reality, almost as though it's a painting, and because you don't see how this modern equipment could ever be brought to this place. But it's there, and they expect to be digging some copper out inside of a year. The whole thing is very, very impressive. You just wonder whether it's economically viable or not. The point of the mayor is that if the Gulf of Aqaba remains open and trade keeps flowing in and out to Asia and Africa, why, then the town can support a population of 30,000 people. That's his position. If that turns out to be the case, it'll be one of the great spots for settling adventurous people, and it could easily become one of the show places in the pioneering sense. It's a very important army point. There's a fortress there opposite an Egyptian point called Ras El Nakab, N-A-K-B, and that's really the defense point of the lowest possible road by which the Egyptians could penetrate into the Negev. The Army Fortress is an impressive place. Duty down there is tough. The naval unit is not so impressive. Duty is also very tough. The construction workers are a tough-looking bunch of people. They're the guys who are working down there for overtime and putting up all of the heavy labor. But it's quite a place. The airstrip is half sand and half asphalt, and there's a new hotel going up, which would make the second one in town, and you can get cold beer, and it's something. After coming back from Eilat, I spent a long evening with Giora and also interviewing several people for various speaking assignments. Giora didn't want to use the machine, so I have some notes from him down on paper. Then the next day after that, we went up to Haifa, and I saw the arms exhibition, which is a perfectly striking thing, particularly from the point of view of the internal production here in the country. It's incredible what they are capable of producing themselves. They can do everything right up through heavy mortars and heavy bombs. They stop short of artillery pieces. From that point on upward, they don't have anything that is not artillery or tanks or planes. But below that, they really have everything. Machine guns and mortars and an incredible number of small detail paraphernalia. And it's a source of great pride. Abu Khushi tells me that 250,000 people have seen it in Haifa, and I know that Perez said that 250,000 people saw it at the first point at which it was set up, a place called Beit Dagon. The conversation with Abu Khushi, by the way, was a very interesting one. He said that the human material of this present Aliyah was excellent, that it was the kind of people they always dream about having, and here they were, and he was certain that they would make a very splendid eventual contribution to the country. As a matter of fact, he thinks that the country can take in 150,000 people a year. He made quite a point of comparing the present situation with 1948, 49, and 49, 50, when the country took in as many as 250,000 people in 1 year, and swallowed them and somehow or other found places for them. Of course, he slid easily over the fact that most of those first people went into Arab housing. I didn't want to challenge him on it. That is empty Arab housing of Arabs who had fled. And he admitted, of course, that the housing problem is the most important thing. He even put it in one sentence. He said, look, a shikun, or a dwelling for a person, is more important than a job. Because all of the Polish immigrants have brought something with them so that they can manage to hold out for the first few weeks or maybe even month. And then they get the 15 days unemployment, well, not unemployment, employment in public works, which the Ministry of Labor puts up if they can't find other jobs, so that they're not really going to starve. But the big complaint is always on the housing, and therefore he said that a shikun was more important than a job. But even believing this, as he does, his point is that the country can take in 150,000 people a year. He also made the interesting comment that unemployment figures have not risen, at least in Haifa, namely that the immigrants which the city of Haifa has obtained have been able to find jobs in the economy, and the unemployment figures have not gone up. No, he sounded quite optimistic and insisted, as a matter of fact, that he was much more worried about the spiritual integration of these people into the land of Israel and the life of Israel than he was about their material integration. And spiritual integration meant to him learning the language, coming to feel at home, getting over the long experience of having lived as Goyim and among Goyim in Russia for 15 years, and coming home to themselves as Jews in language, in thought, in patterns of life, observance, conduct, and adjustment. All of this, which he meant by the term spiritual integration, he said, worried him more than their material or physical problems, which he thought could be solved. It's an interesting point, and he made it because, again, he was stressing the difference between this kind of immigration, namely European, and the North African immigration, where you were dealing with masses of people for whom you had to supply basic things like food and shelter, but who were not educated and whose further integration you couldn't hasten by worrying about it. They have to come to their eventual, the North Africans have to come to their own eventual integration through the process of time. These Europeans can be speeded along very much more quickly, and conversely, may become disillusioned and disappointed much more quickly, so that it's a much deeper and serious problem with them than it is with the immigration of last year. Well, that was about the substance of the conversation with Abu Khushi, which I have fleshed out because I'm summing up all these observances about the difference between the Poles, Hungarians, and Russians, and the previous North Africans and Iraqis. It's a startling difference. It's something which everyone who deals with the 1957 Aliyah must take into account.
The batteries start spinning. Now you can see the spinning.
Yeah.
See?
What is it?
For instance, if you look at this through the window. Now, the point is this. Let's get the light on here so that you can see where you're at. If you could see... Well, first of all, that it's moving.
Yeah.
And secondly, you can see, if you look in here, that it's about at this point where that tape is. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Look at it carefully and see if you'll be sure to see it.
Yeah.
She's... So that means that about 10 minutes, 5:10, means you've got 15, 20 more minutes left.
Yeah.
She winds up down on this end, right? Means she will spin all the way from this side of the spool all the way to this side of the spool. When it all comes onto this side of the spool, it will stop. It's got no more to unwind. That's how you'll know your half hour is up.
Yeah.
So when you're recording, you can keep an eye, not on the dots, that's hard to see.
Yeah.
Keep an eye to see if the thing is spinning.
Yeah, sure.
All right, now let's see. That's all.